Welcome, listeners, back to your favorite podcast, The Pursuit of Perfectness. I'm Ellen Matthews.
And I'm Dennis Pacheco. And maybe it's a little presumptuous for us to say that this is your favorite podcast, but I know in my heart that it's true. We're giving you things that no other podcast is giving you. Mental health, comedy, question mark? But definitely we are delivering on the guests. We have great guests.
We have amazing guests.
Yeah. And today is no different. Today we've got a wonderful cartoonist by the name of Nick Bertozzi, who is an old friend of mine, who's my teacher at SVA. He is a New York Times bestselling cartoonist who has written and drawn many graphic novels and has taught cartooning at the School of Visual Arts since 2003, which is when I met him. Because I
you
was
were in his first class.
First class, which we discovered in our conversation with him. And we get into a lot of other stuff, like learning how to project your voice as a teacher, which Ellen has mastered. And I am still, after 10 years of on stage, still haven't quite gotten the hang of it yet.
Dennis always, when he edits these podcasts, which I'm learning to do, he always has to make my voice softer and his voice louder, because yeah. I'm constantly screaming.
It's a real odd couple situation. Yeah, get right on that mic.
Listeners,
we had a great time talking to Nick.
What a sweet guy.
He's a real sweetheart. He's one of the sweetest guys.
Just
in the world.
So kind.
One of the all-time sweet guys.
And it was also really nice to see your dynamic. I think he really appreciated you as one of his earliest students, and you really appreciated him as your mentor.
Yeah.
And it was just really nice to see that.
Yeah. So you'll get to see some of the history of where Dennis came from, also as a little bonus, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had a great time talking to Nick. He's got a book coming out. It's called Bomb. It's about it's about how the Soviets stole the secrets of the Manhattan Project to create their own atomic bomb, which sounds like the
fascinating.
Well, I gotta say it. Sounds like the bomb.
Right? Ew, that's the comedy part of this podcast.
Yeah, question mark. Please like me. All right. Without further ado, here's our conversation with Nick Bertozzi.
But that's grad school. You're supposed to fail in grad school, right? You fail in order to move forward. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a good
attitude.
That's
what they tell me.
Here you go, F.
The biggest lesson you'll ever learn.
Yeah. It was a mess, yeah.
Nick, I think I might have been in one of your first classes at SVA. I might have been in your first class at SVA.
I believe you were. Was that 2003?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
September 2003.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it. It was a nightmare. The class revolted on me.
What are you talking about?
Well, I had a
this
very...
This is not how I remember it.
I had a very soft speaking voice, and teaching taught me to have the teaching voice, the very stentorian speaking voice that doesn't sound like you're projecting, but you actually are. And that's what you need to have if you have a classroom full of students. Huh. And there was a student in the back who kept saying, "Speak up!" And I would speak up, and then, you know, like any newbie teacher, I would, the volume would come back to my normal speaking voice, which was something like this. And and so we had a break about an hour and a half in to a 3-hour class. And when I came back, half the class was gone. Except for Dennis.
And, I don't remember it that way.
Yeah. There was a full room, and it was and half of them left. And you know who else was in that class was Mickey Duje.
Uh-huh.
Do you know Mickey? Do you remember him? He was an illustration major. Now he's my brother-in-law.
What?
Yeah, so crazy class. And I think, if I'm not mistaken,
crazy class.
The first time that Nick Gazin took that class. Do you remember Nick? Of course.
I still talk to Nick.
Yes. He's wonderful, wonderful. I love Nick.
Dillon, I love Nick.
As I love you, Dennis.
And I love you.
And I'm coming to love you, Ellen. So take some time. Just, you know.
By the end of this episode, I think.
Yeah. But what an incredible class. And then, and to have those three of you stay as opposed to, you know, the other people that left, I don't know who they would have been, but maybe I'd still be friends with them after all these years. But I doubt it. I think the right people stayed and they just gave me a chance. And it took about three classes or so until I finally got that voice going. So,
well, I mean, what I remember is being really like, I loved your class. I was like, this is one of my favorite teacher of like the whole, my whole time at SVA. I was like, this guy gets it. I just really connected with you as a teacher, I guess.
And we've hung out since, and it's been a friendship outside of that too, as well. It hasn't always been, you know, teacher and student. It's way more than that now, I would say. I mean, we don't see each other that often, but we certainly, you know, whatever we do, there's always new things going on in your life.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel so happy when I see you in person.
Same here.
And on video.
Same here.
and I was telling Ellen that I used to intern for you, quote unquote intern, where I'd bike up to Queens from Brooklyn to Jackson Heights every Saturday and just be like your art assistant for a couple hours.
Yeah,
and you'd like cook for me. You'd like make me eggs.
I did?
Yeah. Yeah, you'd cook eggs and stuff. It was awesome.
Oh,
and,
good.
Because I remember I was like, whatever that year was, junior year, senior year, I went to the office at SV and I was like, can I intern for Nick Bertozzi for credit? And they looked at my grades and they were like, no. And I was like, well, I'm going to do it anyway. So I did it anyway.
Yeah.
And I don't regret it.
Good. I loved you that much. I had you in my house. That's not something I do for everybody. I don't think I've done that. The problem with having interns is you've got to teach them, right, while they're doing work for you. And of course, I wasn't paying you, right? I mean, that was long before I realized that what a horrible system that is for the students, right? Because had you gone through the SVA Career Development Office, they would have had you pay $400 to get, I think, three credits from me for being my intern, for doing all this work for me. So, and I always felt so guilty. Yeah. I was like, I got to teach you how to use this part of Photoshop. And this.
Yeah, but I did learn a lot. I mean, thank you. I feel like I went in for all that work. I did mostly like digital color separation and some like, I was like, I can do like fill in blacks, like big areas of black with ink. But I don't think I should have been doing that because like my style of just even that is different from yours, where I was like, my OCD tendency is to like completely black, like jet black, no areas of white. And you have like a dry brushier kind of thing going on where it's like feels more organic and it's like textural. So I still think about that.
Well, you scan it in and you mess around with the contrast and you have essentially dark black. But I get it. OCDs, you know, it can make pages take forever. I get it. There's that moment where you have to step back and, you know, judge, especially when you're up against a deadline. So would that have been 2003 or 2004. So that would have been the book I wrote to you about in the questionnaire. So
that was this book, right?
That was that book. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The horror show.
Oh, you were both working on that in the studio in 2003? Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah. And just to break the... I also have...
Hey!
Listeners, that was the masochists.
I just want to point out that I was the brainiac that thought, yeah, putting a woman throwing up on your cover is going to make people really interested in buying your book.
I mean, I'm intrigued.
I mean, the colors are awesome. The colors are great.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think I also have every issue of Rubbernecker. I was telling Ellen in a box over here, but and I have a piece of original art of yours on my wall. What? That, yeah, it wasn't like from anything. I think you just like made a sketch and inked it for a. Oh, okay. Oh, it was for an auction for CCS, so the school that Robin used to work at.
Yeah,
cartooning college up in Vermont, Ellen. They it's a grad school for comics. And she bought it for me at an auction.
So what
it's
is
up
it?
Here. I'm going to go get it.
Oh, no.
I was debating if I should get it.
He's like, I'm not going to get it. I won't get it.
Yeah, I'll come back. Fill me in when I, yeah. Okay, I'll be back.
This is adorable.
It's
so funny because.
Alumni week. Sorry.
Yeah. No. Dennis has talked about art school in the past and how like it could be really stressful. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to see that like there were other parts of it that were like really meaningful and, you know, well, weren't all about like stress and deadlines.
Absolutely. And if you have, you know, if it always, it really helps, especially if you have favorites. You know, and
yes.
It makes it so much easier to have
yes.
You know, students who are, you know, who are paying attention and are actually asking good questions and aren't just, you know, I think in that first class, most everybody, except for a couple of you, wanted to draw either Batman or Wolverine. And now it would be everybody in my classes wants to draw, well, not everybody. Most people want to draw Adventure Time or Berserk. The manga about the guy with a 6-foot sword.
Huh. Yeah.
I don't know. You haven't read that one? Oh my gosh.
Never heard of it. Even when I was there, there was starting to be like a American manga sort of shift.
Yeah.
I was on the train the other day and I was reading on my iPad, I was reading Daredevil. And it was no like, kidding. It might have been, yeah, it's pretty fun. It was Saturday night, I think. And, you know, people are drunk on the train. It was late. And this one dude, this big white dude, he's like drunk. He leans over and he goes, "What's up, manga?" And I go, "What?" And he goes, "What's that manga?" And I go, "Daredevil." And he goes, "You ever read One Piece?" I was like, "No." And he goes, "No, I didn't say no. I just like looked at him and I went, and I shook my head back and forth. I just went." And he goes, "You ever read..." Ugh, I don't know. Stupid. It's a bad story. I'm sorry.
I was like, is this guy going to fight Dennis? Oh, that's beautiful.
I do that? Yeah. Wow.
Yeah,
that's pretty good.
That's a Bertozzi. Look at that Bertozzi face and those lines.
Yeah. It has my name on it. It definitely looks like my sloppy inking style. But it's a lot cleaner than my usual sloppy inking style.
Yeah.
That character seems familiar. I think I might have drawn that for somebody else's graphic novel, you know, like a pinup or something like that, and just donated it to the school.
Oh.
Maybe. Which
one?
Maybe.
We'll put it on the Instagram. It's like the one with that's like a mummy with a cape that's falling, or the guy with the mask at the fridge?
No clue. But that was...
That is so funny.
I'm a because Robin knows I like you know, I like this style of art and also superheroes. So she was like, "Well, this is for Dennis."
That's so
she was right.
Ella, do you read comics? Are you a comics person as well?
I do not, which is why I was like, Dennis, you're going to drive this one a lot. You've got a lot of experience here. But, you know, I've learned a lot through Dennis, and we had Robin on as well. And I'm learning a lot, and it's exposing me to a whole new world, which I really appreciate.
Awesome. Yeah. It's, I know it can feel, you know, you go into a comic shop and you just see the Avengers or whomever there, and you have to hunt sometimes for the good stuff. That's true. So I can feel overwhelming going into, Dennis, I don't know if you ever called it this, but the comic shop on Broadway and 12th, in my family, we call it Forbidden P or F Planet, Forbidden Planet.
I worked there. But wait, I never heard it called that.
Wait, when did you work there?
2010 to 2011.
Maybe I knew that. Yeah. Well,
that was after I moved back from Vermont.
Okay.
Yeah, I got fired.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
For what?
Because okay, here's the thing. I was in a bike accident.
And I had
like a brace and like a foot cast. And I was kind of in charge of their mailing department. And like, I was too slow going up and down the stairs. Oh. So the guy who, the owner, who's a real prick, and I hope he hears this.
Oh, no.
He like came up to me and he goes, "You're fired." Like, he did it like that. Like, he was angry. Because he would watch. He had cameras set up all through the store and he would watch from his home. Like, people working and if they were goofing off or whatever.
What a creep.
Fuck that guy.
Oh, my God. That also sounds illegal for him to fire you for an injury.
Were you doing your Little Lord Fauntleroy face, though, the whole time?
Of course. Or? Yeah. Pinky out.
Each step is such pain. I need workers' comp.
I said, oh, me, oh.
You know, and then I'd lay the across the
fainting couch. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I also got fired from Comic Place, DC Comics. So
for what?
That I can't talk about. Okay, just kidding. Okay. Of course I can talk about it.
Please tell us.
I say that, but I was going to quit anyway, and I gave them a month notice, which now that I know, you're never supposed to do this because then they watch you like a hawk, you know, thinking you're stealing stuff or something. But they said I was bringing down the morale of the whole department. So a week before I was supposed to leave, they marched me out with a security guard.
Jesus Christ.
Wait, bringing down the morale?
Yeah.
They were just like, you're kind of a bummer. Like, what?
Being seditious and they didn't use that word, but they, you know, making fun of the boss, which probably
that would probably
true.
Boost yeah. morale. That would boost yeah. morale.
So. What department was that?
Marketing. Which I had no business being in. So it was only a matter of time. So I was trying to beat out the clock by quitting, but they caught me. So we're brothers of being fired. I love it. Ellen, have you ever been fired?
I was thinking of this. I think, I don't know if you could technically call it being fired, but I was not asked back. I had like a catering gig. I did some like catering for weddings and events. And then they were like, we don't need you anymore. Because I was too slow. I was too slow and I couldn't carry like the big trays. Because they were really heavy. So we've all been fired.
You know what? I hadn't thought of this until you just said this. I was actually not asked back I did catering once and I wasn't asked back. Not because I could handle the trays. I've been living in the country and chopping wood. So that was fine. But it was, I had no sense of fashion. And I went to Marshall's and bought the cheapest clothes I could buy. And we're in Newport, Rhode Island. You know, trying, you know, these very Tony parties. And when I put on my clothes to go out into the fray, my boss took one look at me and laughed and laughed and laughed. And he's like, honey, I don't know what you're doing, but this is going to be a hoot. And it was, and I just had no idea until later. And I told people the story and said, well, you know, what kind of clothes are these? And it was a, you know, like a $5 tuxedo shirt and the most polyester satin pants with, you know, a seam so tight you could cut meat with it.
Oh, no.
It was sad. It was sad.
I was picturing
thanks
like,
for that memory, though. Like, thanks for that. Well,
usually it's just like a black, like, button-down shirt and black pants, like all black.
or like the party down outfit with the white shirt with like a little black tie or something.
I needed help. I have no idea.
Usually they would like tell you. That's
When did you figure out your fashion?
You mean just wearing jeans and t-shirt and that sort of thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, not too long after that. Yeah. And especially if you're this tall. I know I don't look very tall in my little hutch here, but when you're this
tall. How tall are
you? 6'4". When you've got ape arms
6'4".
Like this, nothing fits you. So you wind up in the basic American attire. So, and that seems to work for most occasions other than, I forgot. When I got that job at DC Comics, I had been living in Philadelphia, and my girlfriend found a tailor for me to get a suit made to work at DC Comics, and because they had a dress code, and it was an old place. It was called Torre, and it was an old tailor. Got up there, measured me. They asked me which side of I dressed on. I don't know if you ever had a suit made or pants made. Dennis, you know that one, right?
I've never had that, but I know it from, like, I don't know, a sitcom or something where, like, dress left, dress right, that means, like, where does your penis go?
Exactly right. Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. I have never heard this in my life. That is wild.
But it was an old Italian place, and they asked me what I wanted to look like. I said, well, it's for business. And
right.
I get the most satiny black suit with a brown, a satiny brown shirt and a satiny, the hideous, most ugly satin tie you've ever seen in your life. And I had no idea until I get to DC. And so I saw how other people dress, and I learned pretty quickly to change to a white shirt to make it look a little more classy. So I looked like the mafia. I looked like and as an Italian American, I feel like I can say that, and I'm not proud of that. It's just
because you went to an Italian tailor, and he was like, "What's this for?" And you were like, "Business." And he goes,
I get it. Business.
Business. Capiche?
Oh my goodness.
I'll have to do a comment.
I'm gonna
that.
Make you look so good.
I did look good for South Philly. That's for sure. Definitely.
Can we talk about I was so intrigued, Nick, by your response in our questionnaire about your book, The Salon. And I wish I could have read it before this interview, but I read a little bit about it online. But it was really interesting to hear that your original version didn't jive exactly with the editor, and you felt that you kind of compromised on what you thought the original true vision could be. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and what that was like for you?
Yeah, I'd been an indie artist, I guess you'd say, an indie comics artist. I've been making comics for 10 years up to that point. Just about 10 years. And so I'd made this comic online, and we'd had a comics website where we'd publish a page a day. And so I'd just been compiling these pages, and eventually I had enough for a graphic novel about Picasso and Braque discovering cubism, but then also drinking this magical absinthe that allowed them to enter into famous paintings. Paul Gauguin is the antagonist, and it was all seemed to be going swimmingly. I got an agent, and they said, "Yeah, I can sell this. I know I'm going to try to sell this right to Pantheon or Random House, you know, a big publisher." And they thought, "Yeah, this is right in the boom of graphic novel, of indie cartoonists making the leap into big time publishing," which seemed great because it was coming with advances, which were not something I knew existed prior to that. I knew rock bands got advances on royalties, but I didn't know that cartoonists could do that. I don't think I'd made a cent up until that point, except from selling comics at comic book conventions. So this was a deal I didn't want to screw up. And so when the agent who worked at a big time literary agency and was incredibly personable and sweet and kind and very interested in me said, we signed on the dotted line. And then they said, now we want some changes. And And I thought, well, wait a minute. Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to be professional. I'm not going to screw up this deal. I need to get an advance. I have a new young daughter. And this is going to be my new world, is making comics for a living. And she had about 80 pages of edits. Some were text edits. Some were full page redraws. And I ended up scrapping about 40 pages and drawing, I think, 30 new pages. Wow. Out of a 200 page book or something like that. And we changed the ending, and we got rid of 3 of the 4 sex scenes, which doesn't, I mean, no, that sounds ridiculous, but that's probably the right call at the end of the day. I mean, their goal was to make it a much more saleable book. And
right.
At that point, I thought, I don't know much about this world, and I'm going to, this person's guiding me. That's why we made this contract together. And somewhere in there, I lost the vision. And I lost the texture of the book. I lost the life of the book and the romance of the book and the, you know, all the other words that people use for a great book. I lost the magic of it. I lost the vision. And that was because I wanted to please. And that's, I don't know, you have a podcast about perfectionism. I don't know if anybody here is a people pleaser, but...
Oh, that's, big time. Big time.
That's something that's haunted me for a long time. And it was a hard lesson to unlearn and to stop wanting to please people just to please them and to be professional in a weird sense. Like, being a professional doesn't always mean being perfectionist, right? It means staying true to who you are as a professional and not letting your vision disappear. And yes, altering your vision a little bit, but not wholesale. Or I wouldn't even say wholesale. I'm not being fair enough to the agent. She was, and the editor, they were so kind to me and sweet, but it really hurt when I came out of the other side and realized I just had not been true to myself. And that, I wanted to be, you know, not to put the period on this sentence too hard, but I wanted to be perfect for them. I wanted to be so the most professional, meet all my deadlines and just make them love me for being somebody that wasn't a problem. Whereas in reality, being a problem is not always the worst thing. As long as you're not somebody who's not doing the work, not getting your work in, you can be a little bit late. If the book's going to be great, they'd rather have a great book than a book that's been rushed. And so, it hurt. And it was but it was a great lesson, because I say to my students now, you know, what you bring is your voice, right? And your voice is, just because you're born with it, it's unlike anybody else. Yeah, you're going to emulate other people to begin with, but the more comics you make, the more you hone in on your voice. And for me, it was, and for my students, it's, we've all had conversation after conversation about this, about, you know, how do you stay true to yourself? How do you know when you're being true to yourself? How do you know when you're faking it? And it usually comes, reflection usually comes from pain, right? from anger or shame or feeling, getting the reaction from the indie audience, or in my case, the deadening silence from the indie audience. And my audience, I'd screwed over by doing this book, in a sense, and going away from what they'd liked so much about my work, the idiosyncrasies, and not to say I shouldn't have made it more saleable, but come to some kind of better compromise with myself.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, like, I wouldn't exactly describe myself as a people pleaser, but I definitely want to be like flawless at, you know, jobs. So getting fired, that hurts. But I was talking to my therapist about this today. It's like, I still have a problem with assertiveness, with just like asserting my own needs and drawing boundaries and being vocal about it. We're working on it.
And you teach, know. Right? Oh, sorry, Ellen.
No. Dennis does teach.
You teach, right? So, do you feel like that a little bit more assertiveness came into your being from teaching? Because that certainly happened for me. When you get that, when you learn that teacher's voice, or when you're up there on the stage, and to me, you seem assertive as hell. Like, you're not waiting for somebody to, you know, to give you the exact prop. You're just, I can tell you're out there winging it sometimes, and you know, that's assertive to me. That, I don't know, not to go psychoanalyze you or anything.
Yeah, I don't know. You should psychoanalyze me. I don't know.
I have thoughts, because I pretend to be a psychoanalyst on the show, even though I'm not.
Yeah.
So here are my thoughts, and I'm actually a teacher too. So I feel like I can finally relate to you both, because I don't know anything about comics, but I know something about teaching. I teach improv as well as Dennis.
And she's a great teacher. I've been in her class. So.
Thank you very much.
I've been a student of both of you.
Oh my gosh.
Amazing. Dennis did walk out the second half of my class, though.
Just yeah, I was just like, fucking speak up.
So my philosophy on this, I think it has to do with power. So I think as a teacher, at least for me, it's still a struggle, because I want my students to like me, but I know that because I'm in a position of power, being assertive actually like gains their respect. And I think, and Nick, tell me if this rings true to your experience, it seems like you were a little bit out of power because you were kind of at the mercy of the editor, right? Like, you're at the mercy of this agency who's going to publish or not. And so I feel like maybe having that power dynamic, you know, makes you feel like you can't speak up because you're kind of at the whim of another person that's outside of your control.
Yeah, I didn't prepare well. And I didn't talk to other people about it. I just assumed this is the way it is. And I didn't do my due diligence. And, you know, it reminds me, my father's an attorney, and or was, he's retired. And I once asked him, I said, well, how do you get up there? And the first time you get up and talked about your client in front of a judge, what the hell was that like? And how did you not run to the bathroom puking every 5 seconds? And, you know, just because it's not just about, you know, teaching a class, it's about somebody's life is in your hands as an attorney. You know, in his case, he was doing bankruptcy law. And he said, I just read all the books, and I talked to every single one of the people in my firm, and I talked to all my friends in law school and my old professors, and just got prepared. You know, ask them any, you know, what is their judge going to think about this? What if the judge is a jerk? What should I do? And that really, he said that was the only way that he could get through it. And he felt calm when he went in, because he felt like he knew the gamut of the variables. So, and with teaching, it's, I don't know, I feel like this, you know, you can wing it once you have a handle on the material, but if you're not also challenging yourself, it's, you know, preparing that way and pushing yourself, then the assertiveness turns into acerbicness, and you're just, you know, that sounds too easy and too trite, but, and that was not a calculation I made before. That's just something that just popped in my head. So, you know, it's very easy to get, I think there's years where I've been a teacher and I've just thought, they don't care. So it was making it so hard for me to care. And to get back to that level of that desire for connection and to assert oneself, you have to, I don't know, challenge yourself. And that's, I don't know, that's been true for my 20 years of teaching cartooning and all sorts of classes, you know, pre-college, teenagers, which is wild. I don't know if you've probably taught improv classes to teenagers or younger, I imagine, and it's a lot different than teaching it to adults.
I haven't.
Mainly it's like 20s and above. Teenagers, that seems tough. That's a whole different dynamic. Yeah. Because
You have to give them your whole attention. I'm listening to you.
Yeah, their egos are such a, yeah, that's another where I'd feel like, oh, this person's life is in my hands. I'm shaping this person's mind. Mm. Yeah, you know, I actually kind of can relate to that story about having a revolt in your first class, because I was like, the way I learned to teach was like I co-taught with Armando for like four classes, and then I got solo classes. In my first solo class, I was like, you know what? Any questions you might have, just chime in, just speak up. You know, this is going to be a place where we can all ask questions and stuff. And pretty quickly, I was like, this was a mistake.
Yes, yeah.
This was a mistake. They would like start to like pick things apart and challenge me and interrupt me. And I was like,
no.
And my voice was like, I'd be clearing my throat. And I'd be like, yeah, this is a good question. Yeah, you got to alpha. I don't know. You got to alpha dog those folks. But it's easy to be assertive when you're like nominally in a position of power,
right,
over people.
Right.
Like the thing I have problems with is when someone has a position of power over me.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's because they do, for whatever reason, or, you know, or if it's, I just perceive it that way. Yeah. And
do you ever
it's
feel
just
like,
hard to say no to people.
Do you ever feel like that, either of you, with an audience? Like they have power over you and they're, because it's
such
kind of
an interesting question.
Struggle in a way, right? You're sometimes you have to fight to keep them in line.
I used to, but at a certain point, I got to the point where I was like, you will do what I want you to do.
There's some assertiveness. I love it.
Yeah. And that's a good feeling.
That's such an interesting question. I don't think I feel a power dynamic with the audience. I think the struggle for me on stage is internal, you know? And I think just being assertive in my choices, right? If I'm like making a choice on stage, if I'm being a character, I'm like, yep, I'm confident in what I'm choosing. And this is okay, regardless of what the audience is doing. If they're laughing, great. And if they're not, I still made a great choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess, yeah, teaching's different because you have, and I imagine this is true in improv classes too, is you have those students who know it all and they're there to just, you know, just give you their litany of information and to perform their information for the rest of the dum-dums in class that they, you know, they to lord it over them in a way. And it's, you know, to make that it's almost brown nosing, but not quite. And it seems like assertiveness, but at its root, it's so insecure. It's such a,
yes.
Yeah.
And when they argue, go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to agree with you that I get those sometimes those students who are like, I have a question. Isn't it better to do this than that? And they're like just giving a note to another student, like passive aggressively, you know?
It's not a question. They're masking it as a question, but they're just trying to say what they think is better.
Yeah.
Yes. I think we all just, we love to be, sorry, Dennis, I talked over you. Go ahead.
No. I was finished.
I think there's something in us that we all have to fight that desire to be righteous, you know, that knowing better and it is also you know a pissing contest too in a way, right? But for these students, but it's, you know, because I guess what comes out of it is you get to know the teacher and become their intern and hang out with them and invite them on your podcast later. And you were never a kiss up or anything like that at all. Never. You're just super chill.
Well, I don't think anybody. Yeah. I don't think anybody was implying that I was.
But also serious. You know, you could joke around, but you could also be serious about stuff, about what you liked, and you had access to that. So I really appreciated that, especially that first year, you know, that first week. To have people that looked interested. Sorry.
I do remember that people yelling out, "Speak up!" I do remember that. And you being like, yeah, thank you, yes. I have that problem with when I was co-teaching with Armando after class. I'd be like, "So, did I project?" And he was like, "Still no." And I was like, "Really?" Because in my head, I'm yelling, and he's like, "Nope, I could not hear you." That's something. I've never learned how to project my voice in this with quite the same force as a lot of other performers.
I sound a lot more after that first class. I ended up sounding a lot more like my father. My voice changed to sound like
his.
So
interesting.
And my grandfather. So there's got to be something in there with the stentorian quality to the voice.
I did have a question for you, Nick, about you mentioned some students don't want to be there, which I find curious. And I'm lucky in that regard because everyone in a level one improv class pretty much wants to be there. They might be nervous, they might be shy, but they want to be there. Like, no one's forcing them to take intro to improv. So how do you find yourself with students who aren't interested? Can't they just not take the class if they're not interested? What are they doing there if they're not interested?
I think it's a four-year school, four-year art school. So I think a lot of them get into the major. Well, you're forced to choose a major, which is pretty normal for a college, yeah. Right? And I think it's that they had this skill in drawing and they liked Rick and Morty or they liked Adventure Time or Steven Universe. Uh-huh. And their caretakers, their parents, their aunts and uncles, whoever's helping them pay for it, the tuition, is just desperate for them to get that diploma. And, you know, the kid has shown interest in this. So therefore, maybe shouldn't they get a major in it? And because they're not going to make it through a four-year comparative literature degree. They're not going to make it through an English degree even. And that's... So I think that's where a lot of that comes from. And it's also, it's a thing where people choke when they've got, you know, when they have to get graded. That's just, I know, yeah, I did the same thing when I was in school. You know, you have to read all these books, these amazing books. What? Yeah, I loved reading. I read Moby Dick on my own, but if it had been assigned in school, it would have been a slog. Right? And that's just that weird dynamic of school. And that's what SVA is, as opposed to an improv class, of course. And had I been, you know, if I were to teach a cartooning class that people would pay money for, I mean, I know you pay money to go to college, but if you're paying your own money and not your caregiver's money, it's a little different dynamic, I think. And
it's true.
You know, lots of kids have, you know, very, very, lots of issues. You know, that make it hard to wake up. And I know what that's like. And so it's hard to sometimes reach them. And that's, I often try to spend time with people and just get a sense of what's going on in their head to make sure the ones that are kind of falling behind and you know, usually it's addicted to video games or problems at home or something like that. So it is hard to concentrate for that reason. And then there's the kids who are just like, I got to be here. I got to get a degree and I don't really want to do this. I hate it. Yeah, once you talk to them, you get a sense of it. But I'm coming into my 20th year and...
Wow. Yeah. Congratulations.
I'm not actually 51 years old. I'm actually only 30, but I only look like this because of the 20
years old.
Teaching. Yeah. it's teaching. Yeah. Teaching. I'll leave it at that. I love it. And also, yeah, it's tough. And it's same with cartooning where you're just like, you know, you can sometimes forget why you're doing it. I mean, everybody that comes on this podcast must say the same thing, right? You're just... You know, you sometimes get a great idea and the perfectionism gets in the way of completing things or getting started even, right? And just putting that first mark on the paper. And yeah, that must be very familiar. And it's, you know, then there's always the questions of like, why am I doing what I'm doing? Well, sorry, I'm babbling to you guys. Forgive me. I'm examining why I do things. Sorry.
That's what this is about.
Sorry. I'm fidgeting a lot. Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're
You're great. I was just going to say, we were joking before the show that we could also title this podcast, How Do You Deal? Because a lot of our questions are like, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, so, how do you cope with that?
How do you cope with that? I'm also very interested to know how you found cartooning and art as your passion. Were you always drawing as a kid? Did you always know?
That is a question I wanted to know myself. I'll answer that I'll answer that by jumping ahead a little bit, and I'll just say, I did my thesis paper in grad school. One of the perks of going to SVA is you get reduced entrance into some of the grad programs, and I took advantage of that, and I did a program that was way outside of what I normally do, and part of that was writing a thesis paper about examining some part of your process. And for me it was what the hell is it? Why am I so attracted to comics? Because I've been making them since I was 6 years old, right? Where does that impetus come from? And for me, what it really came down to was I really love thick contour lines surrounded by huge chunks of color. So I know that sounds maybe goofy, but there's this great book by Eric Kandel called At the Age of Insight. I think that's what it's called. And it's about three Austrian artists in the early 1900s. Oskar Kokoschka, Egon Schiele, and the other fellow that everybody groups in with them, whose name I'm forgetting. I read this book. I should remember it. He talks about, what's the other guy? It's Egon Schiele and Kokoschka and...
Is it Freud?
No. Lucian Freud. No, he was much later.
Lucian Freud? He was much later. But I feel like he's got kind of a Schiele thing, right?
No? Draws the figure in a weird way.
That's a good connection.
But the thing I took out of this book to answer your question, Ellen, is that the author talks about how our brains process visual stimuli, and we take in all sorts of visual stimuli, and because our brains are similar to computers in the sense that we don't actually everything we see, we're not actually seeing. We're seeing a combination of visual stimuli and our experience of vision. And so our eye breaks down visual stimuli into different sections. And one is for color, one is for movement, one is for texture, and another one is for contour, right?
Ooh.
And most of our visual perceptor nerve endings, or I'm doing a massacre on this, on his book. He'd hate me for this. Most of our visual perceptors are round, except for the one that picks up contour, which is rectangular in shape. To me, that's the reason why I like comics. I think that particular visual perceptor of mine is more stronger
defined
than the rest of them.
And
so I love the contour line, and that's, you know, you go to see these great paintings at a museum, you know, a Poussin or a Michelangelo or whomever, and I'd rather look at their drawings any day. They're not constructing with shape and plane and light. They're constructing with the contour line, and to me, that's, I think, the reason why I do it. And part of my reason for asking that was, do I do it because it's comfortable to me, and it's just something an art form that I'm comfortable with, or do I do it because I love it. And I came, and the answer to that was, both, really, kind of. Kind of an underwhelming paper, actually. And I had to do the, when we did the oral part, they were like, this is your thesis, huh? Okay. They like the information, but.
You kind of lost the thread when you started describing the anatomy of the eyeball there.
Yeah,
a little off.
Underwhelming, yeah.
No, that's really cool, though. It's like you're literally just drawn to it. Like your eyes are drawn to it.
Yes.
You're compelled.
Yes.
But what A1. About the, what about A1 the, part. What about the, storytelling piece of comics?
Yeah, I'm being a little glib by saying it's just the line, but for the art, that's true, I'd say. Yeah. But, for the writing, I was a big reader as a kid, and I didn't know how. I thought everybody read as much as I did, and that's not to say, oh, look at me, I'm such a. I mean, I was reading junk. I was reading sci-fi, fantasy novels, but then I would mix it in with, you know,
Moby Dick.
Moby Dick came maybe in my teens, I think, a little later, but in my early years, I was reading. You know, I read, the Nine Stories by Salinger, and that one's,
sure, yeah.
You know, I'm not a particularly great big fan of Salinger, but it felt like adult information to a young brain, and certainly there were dirty things in it that were appealing to a young brain, right? You know, learning how the world works, learning how the human instrument works. We'll just leave it at that. And so I think it was just a natural connection between the two. If I had set my dreams on a course, it would have been for music. But
interesting.
I didn't like practicing scales, but I do like playing music a lot, and I played in a lot of bands, but nothing big or anything, but just like, you know, playing around town and stuff. And it was that. I love that feeling, and that gives me a lot more immediate gratification than comics do, but then you have to deal with other people. And eventually, you know, if you're not assertive, like this is before I became a teacher.
Right.
See, bringing it all back. Yes. Before I became a teacher, I was milquetoast. I was soft as it comes. And what's that?
A milk sop.
A milk sop. That's right. A little Lord Fauntleroy. Muling. I was a mueller. And for me, a rock and roll band, the dynamic for that, trying to say to the cool dudes and cool ladies, hey, can you play the song this way? Was just, that never worked out. And I got a lot of emotional baggage off my chest from watching that Beatles documentary and realizing how much they couldn't stand each other when they were playing music. But then they also loved each other and then couldn't stand each other the next minute. And they were always, you know, like, I felt, you know, very much in line with George Harrison's quitting, and I hate him for it. I think it's, I don't know if you watched that documentary, but.
I didn't watch all of it, but I've seen enough of it to follow what you're saying. Yeah.
That's who I was.
I haven't started yet.
I was so passive aggressive, and I would quit on the drop of a hat. Like, oh, you're not going to play my songs my way, mule.
Well, and so Paul McCartney was very controlling and assertive.
Yeah.
Like very dominant. Like even maybe more so than John Lennon, which I always assumed was like the top guy, but. So yeah, if you're in a band with a fiery soul, like a Paul McCartney soul, it's hard to get your way in. Absolutely.
It was, it was just, I'm so mad, you know, even thinking about that now, I'm just so mad at my younger self for just not, just standing up for myself and going in the quietest voice possible, hey, we should play it this way. And it's just,
In
my life might have meant taking a different turn. And that's, could have been. I don't know. I'm not really sure what happened. I love that it became comics, but I do often wish I was still making music with people. I like that conversation without words. It's the best.
Well, you can. You can do that. Yes. Nothing's stopping you.
Yeah. I have to do my classic over 50 thing and get into bluegrass, right?
There you go.
Start a bluegrass combo and wear fedoras and really talk a lot about Pete Seeger. I don't know. That's so judgmental.
Sounds great.
Who would be in your superstar 50-year-old indie cartoonist rock band?
Jason Little, number one.
That's the first name I thought of. That's the first name I thought of.
He's got the most stentorian voice of all. He speaks with such authority, and he concentrates when he thinks, and
he
gives you his utmost concentration. I love it. I love it. And he's such a wonderful partner just in he helps me with comics. He's my reader, my big reader. And he's unstintingly honest, and I love that. And so he's the guy.
He's such a great listener. Like you said, like when you talk to him, he's like processing and he's taking in what you're saying. He's like, yeah.
He's just finished a book last year called Vagin, about a vagina that's a door in the universe.
Oh,
so
whoa.
And he
this is for adults, Ellen.
Yes, yes. He could not find a publisher for it, unfortunately. Yeah. So it's not. Yeah. It's only in French. So take that for what you will. That's what you need to know about Jason Little. No, I'm just kidding. It's a beautiful, wonderful book. I'm not really doing it justice, and I feel so bad. I love his work so much, and him as a person.
He's got a great thick contour line.
Yes, the best, the best. Yeah. Oh my gosh, you should have him on your show because, he'd love to. It takes him a while to get stuff done. I mean, he'll say this, in public. This isn't some secret. So. He's struggled with that because his work looks so beautiful and every part of it is just beautifully, beautifully worked out, not just in the art, but also in the writing. So a great book. I wish it was published in English. So, but wrong time, perhaps. Wrong time.
Yeah, it's very dirty. It's very dirty.
But not
if you ever followed it on Instagram.
But not in that way, It's I guess
right.
It is. I guess it is. I don't know what I'm. Talking. I mean, look, I'm
I
coming
know.
From
it's a lot of genitalia.
Yeah, which
which look is it dirty? There. It's just what God gave us. Do you dress left? Do you dress right?
Yes. Yeah. Lots of learning. That's new things to learn today. Yes.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask you about was. You mentioned Moby Dick and I feel like your a lot of your work goes back to old timey times, like the Houdini book and Shackleton and Lewis and Clark. And you seem to really relish stepping into the past and creating these
Well,
can you talk about that? I didn't ask a good question.
No, I got that. I've done books about Ernest Shackleton and Lewis and Clark and Andy Warhol is another one I've done recently. Yeah. And really, it's just autobiography. But I choose people that dealt with something or had some aspect of their story. Is perhaps similar to not in the terms of its events, but in the maybe the feeling or let's say trauma about a aspect of something, an event that happened in their life. And so I just use it as a way of talking about myself and getting something out about myself. Like, so my Lewis and Clark book is a book for kids. And it ends with Meriwether Lewis, the leader of the expedition, the scene of him shooting himself, killing himself. I thought that was appropriate for kids, so that tells you all you need to know about my work. But I wanted to talk about that because he had what was called at the time black moods, dark moods, and his father had mysteriously fallen off a horse or under a horse or something like that, and he suffered from terrible black moods. And I know I've had people very close to me who've suffered from the same thing. And so that book was all about honoring that person's ability to conduct this expedition across the continent, which at the time was like a moon landing, coming back. You know, they did unfortunately kill one Arikara Indian. Most unfortunately, just horrible. But it's amazing they came back at all. And it's also amazing they didn't kill more people. That's damning with faint praise, I know. But the book is then about me watching that person and helping that person in the form of William Clark, right? I'm Clark in that book. And so, and that sounds really facile, a really facile way of looking at a book. But this is a podcast, you know, I feel it's okay to talk about that. I wouldn't write about that in the dust jacket because it would be, I think it might cheapen the experience for the reader. But if you've read that book and then you know that, I think that might make it, and you know me, that might make it more interesting. I don't know.
Absolutely.
But you know, when you guys must inhabit characters that do the same thing for you, where you're like,
sure,
I had a bad day, or a bad week, so therefore my character this week is going to be the asshole who's going to shout at everybody or something like that. Not that facile, but there's probably a correlation for some of the stuff that you choose to do, right? Like, I think that can't help but come out in your work. And for me, it's been a good way to hide. And that's always, that's always best, because then you don't have to answer questions about yourself. Except I have verbal diarrhea today. I can't stop talking.
I will say this about the character thing. Like, I sometimes will have an opinion that in my head, I'm like, this is not a great opinion. But then, you know, but this character is going to believe it 10 times more than I do even. And I'll just play it up I'll play it to the hilt, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just like exaggerating a aspect of myself. I think those characters are probably better than the ones where I'm like, I'm making a commentary on this person that I think is an asshole. Do you know what I mean? Like, those always feel like, well, this isn't committed. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Does that make sense, Ellen?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, just lean into this opinion, even if it's not yours.
Yeah, but when it's like a commentary thing, like you know, I don't know, like I can be an asshole because I'm in a car, and when you drive, there's no consequences. That feels like I can't commit too hard to that character. I'm just making a commentary.
Yeah.
But anyway. Speaking of your work, I wanted to talk about your upcoming book, very exciting, from Roaring Brook Press, called Bomb. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. So it's a book about how the Soviets stole the secrets from the Manhattan Project, which is the group within the Department of Defense in the United States that built the first atomic bomb. So Oppenheimer is the main character in the book, as well as the spy, Harry Gold, is another of the main characters. And it's set in just before World War II, and it does a good job explaining a lot of the science behind it, which I had part of the, again, another reason why I do these things is because I learn from them. And in this case, I chose it because I did know the story about the atomic bomb, and I'd even written a blurb for an artist who wrote a book about this called Trinity by Jonathan Fetter Vorm, which is an amazing, amazing book if you ever get a chance to read it. But I didn't write this script, and I wanted to learn from an author who had won a National Book Award or was a finalist for a National Book Award. And I thought, I can learn some things from this person and how to connect to the reader. So that was perhaps a mercenary reason for doing that book, but I'm also...
That was Steve Shankin?
Yes. Yep. And you can read the YA novel right now, but our book will be out next year around this time. But the thing that... So every one of my books, I've been an imposter. You know, everybody suffers from imposter syndrome, right? And I felt that way about as a cartoonist for a long, long time now. I've won awards and I've gotten grants, but it's still just, like everybody, it's just, it sticks around. And so every one of my books, I've always felt bad about my art. And every one of my books, I always concentrate on something new. So this one, some new aspect of cartooning. So this one was inking, because I've never felt like a very good inker. And so this, I got to spend 286 pages relearning how to ink and forcing myself to be good inker. Finally, for the first time in my life. And it was a long time coming. Again, you know, it was, 20 years teaching, 30 years making comics. I'm only now getting around to inking, really. But
so do you still use traditional brush and ink? Did you ever switch to digital?
I did. I did the whole book on Procreate.
Okay.
I know it's evil, but it's...
No, I'm not saying it's evil. That was like, I was just surprised because when I'm thinking that I just assumed that you're, I don't know, that you're old-fashioned and you're using brushes, Winsor Newton's dipped in speedball ink and just drenching the page in black. And I don't know. That's what I pictured. But
I love...
Hey, everybody works digital now.
I love brush. I love the ink. I love the ink, but the thing that is... The thing is...
Italian, it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, I'm allowed. the thing that's so good about... The thing that is so powerful about drawing by hand still is that, especially when you're using pen and ink, right, crow quill pen or a brush, so you have to dip the pen. You have to stop before you put your pen back on the paper. And so in that little section of space and time, that's where a lot of the good thinking gets done. And so when you're drawing on the computer, it's okay. It's great. You use a lot of good shortcuts, but you also end up doing a lot of redrawing because of that. And whereas I think in drawing by hand or inking by hand, you make better choices in the long run. So,
because it slows you down in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I imagine
it forces you to pause and ponder, right?
Yeah.
And focus.
And I imagine, I don't know much about improv really, but imagine there must be, I know in acting you have to really think, right? And a lot of thinking is just stopping yourself from just galloping ahead. And I imagine improv, when you have the ideas popped, a set of ideas presented to your brain or, in your brain screen or whatever you call it, and you're like, I got to get this one out. This is a gem. But then you have to pause, right? And think, but will it lead to a better outcome or will it be a dead end, right? Has that ever happened to you guys?
I think there's a sort of patience that is helpful in performing improv, to kind of make sure that there's a lot of rhythm to improv. So I think like waiting for the beat and kind of knowing when to say something and following that rhythm and being patient with that rhythm. That's kind of how I think of it. What about you, Dennis?
Yeah, when I have like a great, when I'm like, oh, this is a killer line. And, you just have to make sure that you're still here, you're present and you're still listening.
Yes.
Because if you're just like, I'm going to deliver this line and you're not there and you're not in it, maybe it's not going to land, maybe it doesn't work. Because number one, if the choice is between being present and responding honestly versus saying your killer line, always choose be present.
Yes.
Always.
Yeah.
And 99% of the time, you'll get a bigger laugh that way.
It's very true.
And speaking of patience, I just wanted to say what you said reminded me of going back to teaching, which surprised me. I'm learning because I'm still a pretty new teacher. the thing that I find myself telling level one students a lot is slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which mm-hmm. is funny because you'd think, oh, they're starting out, so they're going to be... But no, they want to just, like, you know, gallop ahead, and they're just losing stuff along the way. Do you know what I mean? Wait, what do you think, Ellen?
Yeah, absolutely. Take your time.
Yeah.
Take your time. I think there's, like, I think it's similar to having a conversation with somebody. When you're nervous, you can't stop talking, and you don't want any awkward silences, so you're just filling in the blanks, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like... It's okay to take a beat, and when you do, the things you say sound more profound.
That was really deep, Ellen.
The things you say.
Whoa.
Absolutely. Slow down. Take the paintbrush and put it into the ink. Do you use a paintbrush? What do cartoonists use?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, okay. A watercolor brush, a Winsor Newton brush. Sable, series 7, Sable, number 2, number 4.
I don't know this lingo.
Yeah, I remember, I
number
still
two,
remember
number 4.
Jessica Abel uses a number 4, and I always thought that was like crazy. It's so fat. But anyway.
But gets such amazing lines. Yeah.
She's got the control.
Control.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for just, I'm curious, for digitally, do you use a stylus and it just has different, okay,
yeah. I draw on the iPad and I have an Apple Pencil, I think they call it. And yeah, it's amazing. I do most of my work sitting on my couch now, which is great for my, back in the 90s, I was driving back from Williamsburg on my bike. I don't know. Should I say this online? I was wasted, and I ran into.
We're calling the police right now.
Statute of limitations. This is well over, but this is not. I'm not proud of this, but okay. I ran into a parked car, and a rearview mirror. I hit with my pinky. Went over over the handlebars, but I messed up my pinky, and I didn't have health insurance at the time, so I never went to the hospital to get it set or something. So. When I lean too hard on my drawing board.
And that's your drawing hand.
Yeah, the moneymaker. When I lean too hard on it.
The moneymaker.
And it starts hurting after an hour. But being able to sit on my couch, taking a lot of the weight off, you know, you're not hunching over
great.
It, but sitting up and drawing, it's been great. Mm. But it's also, it's not, it doesn't have the the zest.
Pros and cons. The zest, yes.
It don't got the zest.
You know, I feel the same way. I was doing a writing project the other day, and instead of typing it, I wrote out by hand because there's just something zesty about handwriting your thoughts. I don't know
earthy,
how to explain
messy.
It, but there's, it's yes.
Human.
It's human. Capital Y-O-O-M-I-N. Human. When listeners, we all did the double Italian hand gesture.
It's always okay to make fun of Italians.
The capiche. It is always okay to make fun of Italians.
There's a meme, right? That's a meme going around. That means it's law. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say I'm part Italian, but... I'm just a 23andMe, and we don't know if that's actually the case. So I don't know. I'm having an identity crisis.
I'm also part Italian. We're all part Italian.
There we go.
Get out of here.
But yay, get out of here.
We didn't talk about how your mommy makes gravy and the macaron.
My mommy makes gravy for the macaron. Oh
my goodness.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to... keep you too long, Nick. You've been very generous with your time.
Thank you so much.
You are both so sweet, and thank you so much for it's such a pleasure to talk to you both.
Yeah, it's just great to see
for
you
us too. It was great to meet you.
Great
and
to meet you too.
To learn about this.
Hope to see your show.
I look forward to reading. I was going to say I look forward to reading your books, and I also look forward to you coming to see our shows.
Yeah, you
will
welcome.
Do. Yes.
To come to the show. Why did my voice go so high? That was so strange.
We perform on Thursdays at Magnet Theater. Check us out.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Thursdays. Not every Thursday, so check ahead.
Not every Thursday.
but if people want to find you on the internet, they can find your Twitter. You're Nick Bertozzi on Twitter. And on Instagram, you're also Nick Bertozzi, exactly how it sounds. Keep a lookout
two Z's.
Two Z's, baby, for Zesty. we're going to be on the lookout for Bomb, the true yes. story about how the Soviets stole the secrets of the Manhattan Project to create their own atomic bomb out in winter of 23 from Roaring Book Press. I assume it's a true story because it'd be weird if it wasn't.
Yes.
I'm very excited about that. Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. It's always nice to hang out with you, Dennis. And Ellen, it was so nice to meet you. So thank you very, very much.
That's it for this week. Follow us on Instagram at Pursuit of Perfectness. Write us an email, please, at pursuitofperfectness@gmail.com. We had a guest who promised he was writing us an email and then did not. So you could be the first person to email us. Just say hi. That's all.
Please just say hi.
Is that so hard? If you like what you heard, rate us on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe. Tell your friends. Big thanks to Keith Burgun for our theme music. And until next time, folks, be a little less hard on yourself. And bye.
Bye.